Hi, everyone, and welcome to this latest episode of the UKIS ITEL podcast. Today, our guest is Hannah Ritchie, who is a data scientist and science communicator. She is a lead researcher at Our World in Data. And before we go any further, do go to Our World in Data because their stuff is absolutely fascinating. But we're not going to talk, well, we might talk a bit about Our World in Data. We're going to talk about Hannah's new book, Not the End of the World, How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet. Hannah, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
Not at all. Now, it's a really enjoyable book, and it's a slightly surprising book because, in a sense, it's quite a positive, optimistic book about the climate and the planet, isn't it?
I think if you put it on the spectrum of climate books out there, I think it very much sits towards the optimism side. Like, I think I always caveat it with it's what I term as like cautious optimism or impatient optimism. It's not necessarily this optimism that, you know, everything's going fine and everything will turn out fine. I think it's more the case that climate and other environmental problems that I cover in the book are big problems, obviously, but we actually can make progress on them, and there are solutions there if we want to take that path.
You sort of argue in the book that we're probably doing a lot better than many people think. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I think if you ask people, you know, are we making any progress on climate change? I think most people would say, you know, we haven't made any progress over the last few decades. And while, you know, our progress is far too slow, I think that's a wrong statement. I think if you look at many of the developments, we are starting to make progress, and really critical progress. It's just how we accelerate that. So, like, I give the example of, you know, if you're looking 10 years ago about energy costs and energy costs of different technologies, the technologies we would need to move away from fossil fuels and tackle climate change were just not feasible. I think people have the impression, you know, the solutions have just been sitting there for a really long time and we just haven't built the stuff. I think in reality, the solutions that we need 10 or 15 years ago, they were just way, way too expensive. And actually, a big part of that progress has been bringing the cost of these technologies down so that they're now competitive with fossil fuels. So I think we're now in a very different position from where we were 10 years ago. I think many people think we're just, you know, stagnant in the same position.
Yeah, and one of the really interesting things, you talk about the 1.5 degree temperature rise, and it's worth mentioning that because I think it was this week or last when EU scientists said we're going to breach that level. But you're actually, when I saw the headline, I thought, oh my God. And actually, I was slightly reassured by your book in the sense that you have a sort of positive take on that, don't you, compared to some.
I mean, so I think it's important to define what the 1.5 degree target is. I think people assume, you know, once 1 year we go above 1.5 degrees, that's the target blown. I think that's not true. It's kind of a long-term climate target. So it's kind of the average over, say, 20 years or so. So breaking it by 1 year, which, you know, we could possibly do this year, wouldn't take us beyond the target. But I am quite pessimistic, you know, over the long term that we manage to keep temperature rise below 1.5 degrees. I think the pace of reductions in emissions that we would need to reach that are just way, way too steep. But I think the issue with the communication of that target is people think that target is a threshold. They often think that once we breach 1.5 degrees, you know, we kind of get tipped into this, you know, total apocalypse and just everything falls apart and we get this runaway warming to 5 degrees. I think that's not how the 1.5 degree target is defined. It's climate change is mostly a kind of spectrum of increasing risk rather than absolute thresholds that once you go past a given level of warming, it's the end of the world. I think once we go past 1.5 degrees, we need to fight for 1.6 and 1.7 and 1.8. And every, you know, 0.1 degree of warming we can avoid, we massively reduce the risks.
Are you not concerned? I mean, I've just been to India for 7 or 8 days, and I came, you know, found myself thinking about climate stuff because, you know, India's a massive polluter. There's an awful lot of people. It's a very quickly growing population. And whilst I did go in one electric rickshaw, which surprised me, I sort of thought, you know, and I took your book with me, actually. I sort of read it on the way there, on the way back. But I kind of thought, you know, this optimism sort of sat a little bit uncomfortably with how India got me thinking, which was, oh my God, this is like an environmental catastrophe, not waiting to happen, but happening in front of my eyes. Do you think there's any truth in that, or am I just being one of those doomsday merchants that you talk about in the book?
No, there's definitely truth in that. I think the challenge that we're facing is how do we combat climate change and reduce emissions, while also pulling, you know, billions of people that are currently in energy poverty out of energy poverty. It's those matching of those two ambitions which is so important. You know, if we only tackle climate change and leave billions of people in energy poverty, that's just not acceptable. We need to find a way of being able to do both at the same time. I think what's really key there is, I think India's emissions, for example, will continue to go up for some time. But I think what's critical is, like, India will not go through the development pathway that the UK or the US did, where we were burning so much coal per person for, you know, centuries. And it's only really recently that we've brought that down. I think India will increase emissions a bit per person, but I think it will go develop in a much cleaner pathway than we ever did. And I think that is really owed to the fact that I think the technologies that will need to do so, like solar, wind, batteries, EVs, I think it will incorporate those into its energy system way, way quicker than we did.
Okay, that's really interesting. Now, what I mean, you talk a lot about this, the idea that doomsday narratives somehow inhibit change. I mean, is there evidence of that? Because I suppose the counter narrative would be, we've got a lot of doomsday narratives floating around, and yet public belief in the need to tackle climate change has never been higher. So can't you spin that argument the other way, that actually, for all their shortcomings, doomsday narratives have been quite functional in a way?
You could possibly argue that they've been useful in drawing attention to climate change. And I think if you look at survey data across the world, you know, most people actually are concerned about it. I think there's often this, you know, notion that, you know, the public don't care, or there's really, really partisan and only half of the population care. Like, generally, people care about climate change and want to do something about it. And you can say that partly that is owed to, you know, the flashy headlines and the tension that the kind of extreme scenarios have drawn. I think where my concern comes in is more on the action side. I think there's very little evidence to say that doomsday scenarios can move people from a level of engagement where they acknowledge that climate change is a problem actually into solutions. I think they can often have the opposite effect, where actually we can see that it's a massive problem, but the really extreme scenarios kind of lead us into there's really bad and there's nothing we can do about it now. And I see that a lot. Like, I see it in the emails that land in my inbox, or the other young people that I speak to, where they really are kind of stuck in this state of paralysis because they think that actually what we're doing is pointless and won't help at all. And I think that partly comes from these kind of really extreme doomsday scenarios that paint a picture that's a completely unsolvable problem.
But we're in an environment now where there's a proliferation of doomsday scenarios, aren't we? That's the stuff you hear. But yet that's the environment in which the progress you talk about is being made. So that's what made me a little bit puzzled, is, you know, it's in a context of those scenarios that we're making steps forward. So isn't that evidence in a way that they have an effect?
I think it's very hard to parse out directly this kind of thing led to this specific outcome. I mean, there was a paper published a few days ago, actually, looking at the effect of different narratives on instigating action. And actually what that paper found, one, they found that individual behaviour change is very hard, and actually, like, no clear strategy was really effective in driving individual change. But actually the one that came through as the worst, the least effective in driving action, was the doom and gloom scenario. What it did was it inspired lots of social media action. So people were sharing it online. It's very visual. People talk about it. But it was actually seemed to be the least effective in actually driving action. I think that's kind of where I'm coming from. I get that it draws attention to the issue, but I'm not sure that it actually drives action, which is what we need.
Yeah, I mean, I really like that bit where you talk about doomsday narratives that don't happen chiseling away public trust from scientists. Because actually in my world, there's a very, very clear analogy with the sort of cliff edge talk about Brexit, which was, you know, we're going to leave the European Union, it'll be a catastrophe. And because it wasn't a catastrophe, you get people saying, well, look, they were talking complete rubbish, which sort of ignores the fact that it might not have been a catastrophe, but it still had a negative economic impact, but it sort of drowned out. And I suppose that works a bit like that, doesn't it? Is that if it's not doomsday, then we don't have to believe anything these people say.
Yeah, and I mean, I can already see that. You know, I get those comments kind of thrown at me of, you know, we've had this long trail of really extreme predictions. It hasn't come true. Like, so why should I listen to you now and try to tackle climate change? I think that is like a key risk. I think what's key about this challenge of climate is we need to maintain public trust to drive action for decades. Like, we're talking, this is a decade long journey we're on. And if there are really extreme scenarios that don't come true, like, as I said, yeah, I think it starts to kind of chip away at the trust that people have in climate science and why we want to take action, which is the big risk.
I want to talk a little bit about politics and in several ways. I mean, the first thing is, presumably you're quite reassured by the fact that if you look across Europe, a lot of political parties that were, well, big into climate denialism at one point have moved away from that. The trend seems to be pretty clearly, even on the sort of populist fringes of politics, that parties are abandoning climate denialism. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's fair. I think we've moved on a lot over the last 15 years or so. I think there was very much a very loud camp of, you know, climate change isn't real, or climate change isn't happening, or humans aren't responsible. I think we've moved past that now. I think the debate now is, one, how bad is it going to be? And two, what do we actually do about it? Most of the contention is around the policies, that net zero or the different policies to reduce emissions, rather than the need to do it in the first place.
Yeah, but when it comes to those policies, I mean, there's been some interesting, you know, if you like, weaponization of the climate issue in politics recently. We see it a little bit here. You see it certainly across continental Europe. I mean, your book, in a sense, is a manifesto for sort of individual hope. But what is the manifesto for making politics take difficult decisions that might be unpopular in the short term and might cost voters money? Because that seems to be the crunch point we're approaching now. How does politics, so absent doomsday scenarios, how do politicians persuade people that they need to make decisions, even if they might end up costing people cash?
I think what I'd push back on there, I think there are some decisions and some changes that might cost consumers cash. And there's like a political lens to it where the government can minimise the amount of burden that's placed on consumers on that. But I think the key thing that I think, which really we need to try to bridge the gap in politics, is less of the framing of this as a sacrifice and more of a framing it as an opportunity. I think when we're talking about these policies, I think, yeah, we need to state the climate benefits of it, but I think we also need to emphasise the other co-benefits that come with that, whether it's energy security, whether it's local air pollution, whether it's employment, whether it's, you know, more stable consumer bills. I mean, there are a range of other stuff that people care about and actually care about much more in the near term, which is what they tend to use to vote, rather than long-term climate changes. I think the key to bridging this political divide is to emphasise the other co-benefits and not only talk about it through a purely climate lens.
Do you think there's a danger in some of the rhetoric around climate that it is, you know, sustainability is contrasted with economic growth? I.e. we need to revisit our economic thinking if we're going to create a really sustainable future for ourselves. I mean, it strikes me that in terms of politics, that's a very, very difficult argument to win.
It's very difficult. And I think if we're going to put up environment or climate against economy, I think we'll lose. I just don't think people will vote for it. Like, you can look at, you know, kind of survey data across the UK on what people vote for and what their priority list is. And environment's high, like it tends to come in around fourth place, but consistently number one is economy. And that's what people vote on the basis of. So if you're going to pit up environment against that, I think to me, you just will not get a majority share of the population. But I think the key thing there is that you're not like lying to people by saying that these aren't compatible. They are compatible. And I think we need to emphasise that message rather than this is either or, because I think that's really unhelpful.
Yeah. I mean, actually, there's an interesting contrast, isn't there, between what Joe Biden's been doing in the United States, which seems to me to be based on an inherently positive message, which is there is an opportunity here that we should seize, and the way the Labour Party in this country have slightly backtracked from their green pledges, the $28 billion and so on. Because that struck me when Rachel Reeves first came out with it several years ago, as an inherently very optimistic message about a sustainability agenda actually generating growth. Have you, I mean, I don't know if you want to take a position on this or not, but what was your sense on the sort of evolution of those Labour policies?
I mean, I think to tackle the US first, I actually think Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act has been really, really crucial. I think the key part of that is that I think in most countries in the world, climate is actually not as partisan as people imagine. In the US, it really is. Like, it's really very partisan in the US. But the Inflation Reduction Act has been really popular across the board. And I actually really think the key to that has been Joe Biden placing less emphasis on the climate stuff and more just on the energy security lens, the clean energy lens. Like, he's stuck, you know, the biggest climate bill ever in an act called the Inflation Reduction Act, right? There's a reason climate's not in the title, and it's because he wanted to get support across the board. And I think that's really crucial, even if you're looking in the UK at the kind of politics. I think again, if you're going to promote it as a, we need to make the sacrifice in order to address climate change, you just won't get votes for it. I think it needs to be framed as this growth opportunity, which I actually really think it is.
So this is what people of my generation know as an intermission. So while you grab your Kia Aura and your vanilla ice cream, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter, because there you'll figure out everything we're doing and get yourself places to our exciting range of events. Subscribe.
And I suppose the other thing you can frame it as, which strikes me as working in the US, is as a security issue. And, you know, in the US, quite a lot of framing of the climate stuff is in terms of competition with China, not losing out to China in this new sort of race to become the dominant climate power. Is that fair, do you think?
Definitely. And I think it's very clear to see that China's actually moving really, really quickly on this. One, from a domestic standpoint, like the pace that they're building clean energy, the pace that they're rolling out electric vehicles is like quite staggering. But they're also just playing a massive role in international markets. Like if you look at any of the minerals that we need to move to renewable energy or to move to electric vehicles or batteries, China's completely dominating the refining chain there, and they're becoming a massive export market. So I think the US can see that. I hope that the UK and Europe can also see that and actually see that there's an opportunity here, and failing to actually act on that could actually have quite negative consequences from an economic standpoint.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Now, we've been through quite a turbulent few years in this country in terms of the role of experts. You know, think back to 2016 and the role of scientists, you think COVID. I mean, does government work well with scientists, do you think?
I think it's quite hard to like peek behind the scenes. I think often in government you'll have like a lot of kind of background groups that are, I mean, I know the UK government has a group specifically focused on data, and we've interacted with them and they are looking at data to try to make better decisions. I think this notion that, you know, no decisions are ever made based on data or experts aren't trusted, I think that's untrue. How that ultimately filters up to, you know, the final decision that's been made, which I guess has to incorporate what it thinks public opinion is, what it thinks the, you know, the response will be, is probably a little bit more complex than that. But I think behind the scenes, a lot of decisions are made based on data.
Okay, well that's very optimistic. I mean, one of the things we've wrestled with during the time we've been doing what we're doing is the fact that quite often a couple of anecdotes trumps a huge amount of data. We see that, for instance, when we talk about immigration, that you can have all the sort of aggregate data you like talking about positive economic impacts, but you can have one case study of a plumber losing out to a Polish competitor who is undercutting them, and that is the thing. Do you feel that frustration? Do you come across that in your work?
Yeah, I come across it a lot. Like even if we're talking about, you know, clean energy, and I spend a lot of time trying to push back on kind of wrong headlines and kind of what you'd say as myths about clean energy and the energy transition. But it just does need like one story to break through that kind of undermines all of the data that we want. Like I can present all of the data I want on, you know, the fact that, you know, electric cars have a really long range now. Like it's very unlikely that you break down on the motorway. Like there are charting points, but it just takes one story of one person breaking down on the motorway, and that kind of undermines that. So I think that is the key challenge there.
Yeah, I mean, I've got so many anecdotes of my own about electric cars. It is quite interesting. They're the things that sort of grab you, aren't they? The story of, you know, your mate who got stuck on the motorway, rather than the fact that the data overwhelmingly suggests that it's getting far, far better. But do you think in general people are well enough? I mean, it's always struck me that one of the issues we have is that we don't educate kids at school well enough about data, about statistics and about things like that. And we could do a lot better at that. Is that just me being a sort of curmudgeonly old git, or do you think there's a degree of truth in that?
No, I think there's definitely truth in that. I think data literacy in general is an issue. I think the problem is that often you only need to put one number out there, and people that automatically draws people to trust it, right? Like as soon as there's a story that has a number in it, that you just take that number for granted, and that kind of gives this kind of truthness and this authenticity to that particular story, which can actually be pretty damaging. And if there's not data literacy around that to understand what does this metric mean, is this a big number, how does this fit into different contexts, I think that's the key danger there. I mean, I think this is really also critical to the work that we're trying to do at Our World in Data. I think the challenge is, like, often the anecdotes come from either social media or mainstream media, and they get the flashy headline. And actually, I think our notion at Our World in Data is that, you know, these stories just don't help you understand the world, right? You can't understand the world through a basis of just anecdotes that make it onto the news. You actually have to step back and look at the broader data to understand the context, to understand how trends are changing over time, and to get some sense of magnitude.
So when it comes to Our World in Data, I suppose one question I've had is, who, you know, when you talk about these things, who are you for? Who is your audience?
I mean, I'd say our audience is very broad. It's used a lot across, like, many, and we have many different topics. So it's not just environment, you know, we have poverty, health, inequality, all of that sort of stuff. And I think one is the general public. Like, I think we just have a really broad kind of general user base of people that are just interested about the world and want to understand it. But we also have a big base in kind of almost like secondary sources. So journalists who use our stuff to then tell a story or promote it further. We know that policymakers and politicians use it a lot. And then I think also key is the kind of research community itself. I think some of the challenge that we see within research and kind of data use is that often this stuff is not public, it's not easy to use. Therefore, researchers are doing the same stuff on their own computer over and over and over, where they could just, you know, go to Our Own Data, everyone's using the same data from the underlying data source, and then we save them a ton of time. So it's not this, you know, exercise where researchers are just repeating over and over and actually not making progress forward.
And actually, our experience is that quite often academics are very good at writing the scientific paper, very good at perhaps writing the book, but sort of stop before the crucial last stage, which is, you know, which we often find ourselves saying to social scientists, which is, now write us 800 words that, you know, anyone you know can read and understand, and tell us why that's important. And I think sometimes that's a perennial frustration of mine with academia. And I imagine the same thing is true in your world as well.
Yeah, I think that partly motivates the work that we do, because often the data and research is there to answer really crucial questions. It just never really makes it out to an audience that can then use it, that can form policies, that can drive innovation. So we kind of want to be that bridge and that kind of translation role between research and the public. I think there's probably a couple of reasons for that, or why that doesn't happen more. I mean, we're just not trained to write for a general audience. Like, I come from a scientific background, and like, at no point in time did anyone show me this is how you actually write for someone in the general public to understand. And I think there's often just like very little reward for researchers to do that. They're often under pressure for grants or teaching or other aspects, and the focus then is just on the academic research, and there's actually very little reward for public communication.
One of the things you said was your work is used by the general public, and this is purely self-interested, because we wrestle with this all the time, that we aspire to reach a general public. In reality, we reach a pretty well-educated public rather than a general public. I mean, is there stuff you try and do? This is simply so we can copy you, if there is. Is there stuff you try and do to extend your reach to sort of, I hate to say it, but normal people, ordinary people? Is that part of what you try and do in your communications work?
Yeah, we certainly try to do that. I think I should caveat general public by saying I also think we probably pitch to like a higher education level audience. Like, we've done kind of surveys on this, and you know, the readership tends to be, you know, university or higher, like as a base level of education. I think part of that is just when you open Our Own Data, there's just a bunch of charts. So I think it needs to be people that feel comfortable with trying to interpret data and understand different trends. I think just the really fundamental stuff of trying to write in really plain and obvious language. I mean, that's not just to, you know, pitch to a general public. I think just in general, that's a good way of communicating. And then I think that what's also really key, I think, is the kind of interactive charts and visualizations, where it allows people to explore the data. It's much more intelligible than, you know, just a static chart that's often really complicated. So we put a ton of time into, like, how can we make these visualizations as clear and simple as possible while also communicating the message.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we're experimenting with is the things like TikTok, so different mediums to get stuff around. But ultimately, I mean, the fact of the matter is there's a reason why hard to reach groups are called hard to reach groups, because actually, you know, it is very, very hard to get them to engage in the stuff we do. Your time at the World in Data, have you sort of learnt tricks, I suppose, for being more accessible than academics really are? Is it as simple as simply saying we should write well? Or, I mean, what are the key takeaways from your time at the World in Data about how to communicate often quite complicated science to non-specialist audiences?
I mean, I think my work has improved massively over the time that I've been here. I think if I look back on my old work, I kind of cringe a bit, because I think my writing has evolved a lot. I think I initially was maybe like slightly better than the average academic about writing accessibly, but like not much so. Like I think we do automatically come into this with the need for, I need to caveat this, I need to give the assumptions, I need to give all of the limitations, the way you would do an academic paper. And that's kind of hedging, which from a scientific perspective you always want to do, because you want to protect the fact that I know my stuff and I can reference all the literature, which for a general audience, you know, you just don't need to do, and actually is detrimental. I think actually one of the key pieces of feedback that I got actually from Max one time, which has really changed, and I really have it in my head every time I write, is that, you know, you should try to write the way you would talk. Like, I think the issue I would have is I would write an article that was really long-winded, like loads of caveats, and then I'd speak to Max about it, and I'd explain, you know, what the crux of the argument was, and he would say, okay, but I've just read your article and it didn't say that. Like, just write what you just said to me now. And I think that's, you know, now what I have in my head is that I try to write almost like I'm just sitting next to someone and just sitting and talking. And I think that's very different from the way that you would normally write in an academic way.
Yeah, Max, for those who don't know, is Max Rosa, who, yes, I think founded the World in Data, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I mean, when I write, I try and write for my mum, which I find sort of works. But I have to say, your book reads beautifully. I mean, it reads like you're saying it. I mean, actually, that's one of the great triumphs of your book, I think, is you can read it like you're having a conversation. So, I mean, you've succeeded in that. I mean, the thing, after sort of 20-odd years as a sort of normal academic, the thing that slightly depresses me looking back now is I don't think there's anything I wrote then, whether it's a journal article or a book or whatever, that I couldn't have done better as an 800-word blog, which is slightly sort of soul-destroying in one way, because you kind of think, Christ. But, I mean, it does take practice. I mean, actually, here at UK and Changing Europe, one of the things that takes up most of our time, I would say, is editing. It's getting the content and editing it. But I want to end with something that really, really struck me about the book, is that you show a preference for sudden, massive change over small, incremental change. And can you just talk us through that? Because in a way, that's slightly counterintuitive, isn't it? Because you might think the way to do this is small steps, you know, not do anything too dramatic. But you take the other approach.
Yeah, I mean, I think the caveat, like, I think like one of the key ethoses of our own data is that if you look at long-term trends on stuff like, I don't know, child mortality or maternal mortality or many of the human well-being metrics, I think what's key there is people underestimate how massive these changes have been because they're not making the headlines. And the reason they're not making the headlines is because they're not events, right? They're almost incremental changes day after day, year after year. And I think the what you take away from that is, okay, so then, you know, she just thinks that small incremental changes matter. I think what's key is that these are large incremental changes. Like, the numbers, actually, when you break it down, of the changes day to day are actually really, really big. We just don't see it because it's happening day to day. I think on the climate energy stuff, it's slightly different. I think partly because this stuff is moving so quickly now, I think now if you're looking at trends on energy costs or energy deployment and you're like a few years out of date, like you do not understand what's going on, you're really, really out of date. And that's because these changes are happening really, really quickly. They tend to follow, these technological changes tend to follow what we call an S-curve, which is looking at the deployment over time, where very early on you get very, very slow growth, but you kind of reach this kind of positive tipping point where you get really, really accelerated and very, very fast growth, to some extent exponential for a while. And these are really transformative changes that tend to come from nowhere. And I think they will ultimately be the changes that move us onto a much better path. I think the key here is that, you know, the small incremental stuff is just not going to get us there. Like the time now to tackle this is like way, way too tight. So we do almost need these really kind of stepwise changes rather than just, you know, if we just, you know, recycle our plastic straws and our plastic bags, that'll get us there. Like, that's not going to get us there. We need to look at these really big fundamental changes that will change our energy systems and change our food systems.
But my God, having trillions of dollars of investment behind it is going to help quite a lot, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. As many trillions as you can, is fair.
Well, listen, I mean, this is an oddity in the sense that we've had a positive, upbeat podcast for the whole episode, which I don't think we've ever done before. I spend my life surrounded by morose social scientists who go around saying we're all doomed. So thank you very, very much indeed. Can I just say congratulations on the book? I hope it does as well as it deserves to do, which is very well. I enjoyed reading it. And thank you ever so much for joining us on the podcast today, Anna.
Oh, thanks very much. Really enjoyed the chat.